Star Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Hometown friends, serving your best banking interests in every way. Now, here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio historian collector, Ed Corcoran. Ed, who's our guest tonight?
We have Evie Juster, a very famous soap opera heroine, and currently starring on CBS Mystery Theater, Dick.
Evie, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the Golden Age of Radio. Does that bother you, the Golden Age of Radio, when you think back to it?
Oh, you mean calling it the Golden Age when I think back to it. And it was. It really was. It was beautiful.
You were perhaps one of the most active actresses in the business during those days, weren't you? You're active today, of course.
Well, you see, today we don't have very much radio. It's been replaced with talk shows and music shows and quiz shows, all the contestants. And so the radio world as we knew it is just squeaking along. We do have the mystery show, as was just mentioned, which is in its third year, which is rehearsed and done, taped, at CBS.
You can flip that dial, as you know, Ed, during the course of an evening, and you'll hear the CBS Mystery Theater originating from St. Louis on one station, and it might be coming from Rochester on another,
mm-hmm.
or it could
mm-hmm.
be coming in at a different time
mm-hmm.
period
oh,
altogether.
Does. Oh, yeah. Well, you see, the interesting thing is, to my knowledge, the show that is played in New York at 7 during the week, you know, Monday through Friday, that same script is played in other cities the same day, but at a different time.
Evie, how did you get started in this business? Because you really weren't a radio actress as such. You were a stage actress, and there was a mighty big difference.
Well, there is a difference, but, oh, I love this subject because, well, how did I get started? I don't know how I got started. It's true. My orientation is theater, and I love it. And when I was a kid and growing up, I'm from Minnesota, from Minneapolis. And any time there was any kind of a production, I managed to get in it. And when I was in college, of course, prior to that, high school, I tried out for the drama club, and I got in. And I was a lead in the class play, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it, and I'd get up at dawn to be at rehearsal before classes in the morning. And then when I went to college at Minnesota and graduated from there, I had my major in drama, and also, I just involved myself, and then when I left Minneapolis, and my life had a few turns and twists, and ended up here in New York. I just somehow fell into the radio area, which in a way is good and it isn't good, because it took up a life for me that was great, and I didn't spend that much time outside of it except for television, which came in, and I got very busy in television. And I'd like to digress here for a minute, because do I have the time?
Oh, you certainly do.
Well, I'll tell you, I worked with, you mentioned the mystery show, okay? So I'll stay with that for a minute. And then I want to talk about, and please remind me if I forget, about the different mediums of acting, radio, theater, films, and so on. Okay, don't forget to ask me if I forget.
I promise.
Okay, because I wander. Now, last summer, or prior, whatever, on the mystery show, because the producer, High Brown, who's really quite phenomenal, really phenomenal. He gets good audiences with his celebrities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's very loyal to people like myself who have worked with him for years and whose work he knows and trusts. But he gets audiences. I mean, you have to be practical. He can get good listening with names. I'm not really a celebrity name. I work, and I hope I always will work. But when you have a Julie Harris, for example, or someone of that stature, that is another area, right? Okay, well, Julie Harris was on the show one day, and she's not the only star that he's had on his show, and nor with whom I have worked. I've worked with a lot of stars. But we were talking after the show, she and I, and she said to me, "I'm having a ball. I'm just adoring this. I've had the best time today." And I said, "Well, marvelous." I said, "You're very good. You should have a good time." And she said, "You want to hear something?" She said, "You know, when I came to New York, I couldn't get my foot in the radio door. I couldn't get a listen. Nobody would listen." And I said, "Well, that's really too bad for them, but marvelous for you." I said, "Because you turned to the theater, you know, and it's their loss, certainly, you know, and of course, she's so gifted." And it was really kind of interesting because she turned to the theater, and it's just one of those, I had turned in another area, another direction. Well, I've done theater, yes, and I love it, and I do feel it is, if I may say so, it's the most complete area for acting.
We'll get back to those three different categories later, and that's a promise. But first, Ed, let's listen to an excerpt from one of the many shows that E.B. Jester has appeared in, Cavalcade of America.
The DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware, makers of better things for better living through chemistry, presents the Cavalcade of America. Tonight's star, Robert Montgomery.
Our adventure began as a secret Air Force mission to inspect Pacific air bases in World War II. By way of preface, I wish one point to be understood. What follows is almost all out of memory. Therefore, the sequence of events may be rather uncertain. But any such discrepancies that exist are unimportant. My instinct then was not to remember, but to live.
"23 days on an open raft in the open Pacific. This is tonight's DuPont Cavalcade, The Raft. A true story starring Robert Montgomery as Eddie Rickenbacker.
When the gas gauge of our plane hit zero, we quickly made all possible preparations for a forced landing in the Pacific. Adamson was on the flight deck, his back braced against a mattress. The others were flat on the floor or strapped to their bucket seats. I held a parachute against my face to protect myself against flying glass. Very little was said. There was very little to say. At one point, Adamson looked up at me.
"Rick, I hope you like the sea. I think we're going to spend a long time on it.
Here we go." In a matter of minutes, Colonel Adamson and I were on the raft, pushing away from the sinking plane.
"Rick."
"Yeah, Hans."
"Where do you figure we are?"
"Well, by the time we ran out of fuel, I think we'd overshot Canton Island by a pretty good piece. I figure we're drifting towards the Fiji Islands."
"Or the Gilberts."
"Maybe."
"Japs there."
"Yeah, I know."
"I was thinking, Eddie."
"What?"
"Heck of a mess I got you into."
"How do you figure you got me into this?"
"Well, when Hap Arnold picked someone to visit the Army Air Force units preparing for overseas action, someone he could trust to bring him an honest account of how we stand, he figured you were the one who could fill the bill, and he asked me to carry the message to Garcia."
"We've seen a lot."
"We know a lot.
That's right.
Top secret stuff.
Uh-huh.
Eddie, they say the Japs have a drug. It loosens you up, makes you talk.
Forget it.
I've got my pistol loaded.
Forget it, I said. Let's think of something pleasant.
What, for instance?
Well, it doesn't matter much, Hans. Looks like we're going to be around here for a while with plenty of time to do nothing but think and remember. And so began our waiting. The sun went down swiftly. A cold mist gathered on the sea and the moon came up. Why I thought of it then, I don't know. But out of the shadow, out of the gloom, came a picture. Our old frame house on Livingston Street in Columbus, Ohio. The living room with the shades drawn. And 8 kids, strangely quiet. And then Mother talked to us.
You will never see your father again. He's gone. But his spirit continues to live in all of you. Tried to be as good as he was. Always. Now we must not be afraid. Your father was never afraid. He had faith. He had faith in God. In himself. And in this wonderful country he came to many, many years ago. There's only one way to stop fear. And that is through faith.
Mother.
What is it, Eddie?
I'm not going back to school.
But, Eddie, you're too young to leave school. You're only 12 years old.
We need the money, don't we?
Well, yes.
I'll go back to school when I can. Maybe work nights or something, but right now I'm going to get a job. We need the money.
Eddie, I was just thinking.
Yes, Mother?
I was just thinking how little you look sitting there in your father's chair.
So you want a job here in the Federal Glass Works?
That's right.
Kind of young, ain't you?
I'm 14. And I'm finished school.
Kind of puny, ain't you?
I'm as strong as a horse, and I can fight every kid on my block.
What's your name?
Eddie. Eddie Rickenbacker.
You say you're 14 and finished school?
That's what I said.
I think you're lying about the clock, but I can't prove it. Okay, start tomorrow.
That was a long time ago. And now on a tiny raft on the Pacific, day dawned and brought a glassy, sizzling sea. One of our boys, Sergeant Alex, was in a bad way. He was only a kid, barely 22.
Hi, Captain Rick.
How you doing, boy?
Well, not so good.
You're young. You can take it.
Well, maybe, but... See, I'm just out of a hospital.
Oh.
Yeah, they yanked out my appendix. I was just flying back to Australia to join my outfit.
Well, now you stick with it. Won't be long.
Yeah, I know. Won't be long.
Attaboy. You keep at it. You're a good gimper.
What?
Gimper.
What's a gimper?
Don't you know?
No.
Well, never mind. Here, take my handkerchief and tie it over your face. It'll shade you a bit from the sun.
Thanks, Captain Rick.
That's okay.
And don't worry about me. I'll be, you know, what you said.
A gimper?
Yeah. A gimper. A good gimper.
On the 23rd morning, the sun rose, and within half an hour, it turned terribly hot. I watched for seaweed and debris, anything suggestive of land. I was worried. I wondered if we drifted past land, if we were again out in the open sea, drifting away from the air lanes, away from rescue. Then we heard it.
Us, Eddie. He's flying low and he sees us.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Oh, merciful God.
So ended our 23 days on the emptiness of the Pacific. We survived, all but one survived. We never doubted we would, because we had faith. I think of this often as I read my paper and listen to my radio. Today, the whole world seems to be adrift on some ocean of fear. Yet I still have faith. We all must have faith. And if we keep that faith, we will survive.
Our thanks to Robert Montgomery and the Cavalcade Players for tonight's story.
Cavalcade of America with tonight's guest, E.V. Juster. We'll be back in just a moment.
If your car has just about been making it through the winter, then drive into spring with a new car. Dealers are offering some great buys right now on remaining 1976 models, as well as new, more economical 77s. Visit one of the offices of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank or their Cromwell Savings Bank division and ask them to help map out one of their convenient auto loans for you. They'll help you purchase that new car quickly and easily, and you'll get low-cost bank interest rates, too. At both Farmers and Mechanics and Cromwell Savings, you can count on friendly and accommodating service. So check into an automobile loan soon and drive into spring with that new car. You'll find a friendly loan officer at any one of their six offices. Cromwell Savings has two, one at the corner of Main and West Streets in Cromwell, or the new Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you, two in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. Stop in soon. Members FDIC. And now back to Dick Bertel.
Our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio is E.V. Juster, who has appeared in, you name the show, and I guess, E.V., you've appeared in it. You did all of it. The daytime
a lot,
soaps?
An awful lot. Yeah.
You well, did the nighttime shows?
Yeah, yes. The very first show I did in New York was Just Plain Bill. I had a running part on that soap opera.
Oh, well, what was the part you played?
Oh, gosh. I don't remember the name. It's so long ago. But it was a very exciting day for me because I had read for it, and I got it. And, of course, it was very exciting for me. I had been in New York several months, and I was having a kind of a tough time of it because I couldn't get my foot in. As Miss Harris had said, she was having trouble. Well, I wanted to stay in New York, and knowing that my background, I thought, would lend itself to some kind of work in this area, I applied for a job.
Mm-hmm.
I applied for a job as an air controller. Now, okay, why? Well, I'd had a lot of voice work, and I thought, well, they have to be able to understand you. They have to know you can articulate, and that's probably a pretty good place for me. So I applied, and I was accepted. And the day I received a telegram saying that I had been accepted for this job was the day that I got the call for Just Plain Bill. Needless to say.
Rather be an actress than an air controller any day.
Or crash a few planes in the air, which I probably would have done, unfortunately.
Well, I know you started in Let's Pretend, but you weren't a juvenile at that time. You apparently went through school first before you started with the Let's Pretend show, so you actually were playing a child, but you actually had grown up. Is that right, Evie?
That's right. I was already a college graduate and had come to New York, and that wasn't easy either because Let's Pretend, which was a really marvelous show, I have to say. It was really marvelous. I can still sing. As a matter of fact, on the way up here, we were singing the da 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 da. That was a theme song on a Saturday morning.
Sure.
And it was fun because you played Snow White or you played one of the sisters, or you played Cinderella or, all the marvelous old stories, you know. And that was a show that a woman by the name of Nyla Mack, that was her baby. And the people that worked on that show had grown up with her, like Susan here, your little darling daughter.
Yeah.
And that was when they started, and they grew right on up, you know, as they matured. So people like myself who already, you know, I was just out of college, and I wasn't a genius, so I wasn't 17. So I had trouble. I couldn't get on. And I had to really, I had to sweat it out. And I sweated it out. And it really, I'd like to say it was my first show in New York because it sounds so good. But I just adored to do it. I just adored it. And unfortunately, Miss Mack did die. And when Mr. Gene Hite came in, because I'd worked for him, I got on that show. But it was a joy to do.
Well, I can imagine. Let's get back to just plain Bill, the barber of Hartville, as I recall.
Was that what they called it? Oh, was that fun, except the funny stories that happened to you. It was so funny because a man by the name of Arthur Hanna directed it. And, you know, you have one microphone and all these people, and I was nervous.
Sure.
And so I wanted to get to that microphone. I had my lines to deliver, you know, and I had to do what I was supposed to do dramatically as well. And I had to get in there. Now, you can't put your script in front of somebody's face across around the microphone, which is easy to do. Where are you going to put that script if you're not, you know, you haven't had that much experience in New York? I mean, nervousness will make you do a lot of things that you wouldn't do ordinarily. I couldn't get into that microphone comfortably. I was having a terrible time. And we weren't on tape. Was live, so he couldn't put the thing, stop it, and say, Evie, all right, now get in. I mean, you know, you got lines to deliver. Just do it. But so you had to say, I got to do this no matter what. So elbows go into somebody's rib on this side, and elbows go over here, and you're on mic. And because they have more seasoning behind them, you know, were able to withstand this onslaught. But when you think of these things, you really blush.
Well, that was really the start then for you. And then you began to work in all the soaps.
Mm-hmm. And then I worked with a lot of stars. And then there was a program called Philip Morris Playhouse. I had a lot of fun on that because that, again, was with the stars, you know. And I worked with George Raft and people like that. And it was great, great fun.
Did you have any different feeling, Evie, about doing a nighttime Philip Morris Playhouse than you did about, well, just plain Bill? Was there more tension? Was it a different ball game, in effect?
It's a good question. Very good. Yeah, it was. I'll tell you why. It was like going to a formal dinner as against going to a casual supper. You know, I mean, you're dressed. You'd get a little bit more. A little bit more rouge and a little bit more, you know, together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun. Really, it was really great.
Didn't some of the actors sometimes go out and maybe have a few after-dinner cocktails and maybe come back a little bit different than when they did the first show? Did you find that to be true in your case?
Well, I heard about these things, but I really truthfully never saw it. I didn't. But there was, there was so much work. You know, there was so much work, and there was a standing gin game at one of the across from CBS. You know, it was always there, and if somebody had to go off to do a show, their hand would be picked up by somebody else. They'd come back and pick up their hand, but there was so much work. You know, one show after another. I don't even know how many were on the air a week, and now we have one.
Yeah.
You know.
Were you working 7 days a week?
Yes, you worked on weekends. That's right. I mean, we mentioned Don before, Don McLaughlin, and he was Chaplain Jim, among God knows how many other things. And that was aired, that was done on Sundays. And I forget some of the show. Well, Let's Pretend was done on Saturday. And there were some shows done Saturday evening, if I'm not mistaken. I used to do another show. Gee, I've forgotten the name. It was Sunday morning. I wish I could remember all of the names because perhaps the audience does remember them, but right now my mind is blank in that area.
Maybe we can bring something back. How about another show that that you appeared in? You appeared in so many. As a matter of fact, Just Plain Bill would be just the ticket, Ed.
Yes, with that harmonica introduction, wasn't it? The mouth organ to play the theme. Yeah, let's do that one, Dick. That's one of my favorite shows, too.
Now, to the many friends who wait for him, we present Just Plain Bill, Barber of Hartville. The story of a man who might be living right next door to you. The real-life story of people just like people we all know.
Danger threatens Bill Davidson and Nancy, his beloved daughter, and Carrie Donovan, her husband, because of the mysterious, sinister actions of Ira Brewster, who beat Carrie for district attorney by lying about Nancy's supposed parentage. Brewster has named Bill's friends, Mr. Willoughby, retired district attorney, and Dr. Broughton, to investigate the murder of Mrs. Sarah Bryant at the county farm, supposedly a charity home for the aged. Bill believes Brewster himself ordered Mrs. Bryant killed to keep her from exposing fraud and brutality at the home. And now a woman waits in the room at Ira Brewster's luxurious home, Mrs. Daniels, who with her husband runs the county farm. Brewster comes hurrying in, closes and locks the door.
What are you doing here, Mrs. Daniels?
You don't have to act like this, Mr. Brewster. Nobody saw me come here.
I told you to keep away from me, didn't I?
But I've got a right to know what's going on.
You've got a right to know what I want you to know, and that's all. So nobody saw you come here, eh? Nobody but three of my servants, that's all.
Well,
what if they call to testify in court? How's it going to sound if they say you and I had secret meetings here in my house? You fool.
I don't see any reason for all this secrecy.
Do you?
Not the law. Anyhow, you told me it's all fixed.
It is. And it will be as long as you have sense enough to do what you're told. But if you keep coming here in broad daylight...
Why don't you wait till you find out why I came?
Well, why did you come?
Because we got a call at the county farm this morning that Mr. Willoughby called. Say he's coming out to question us.
Well, you know what to tell him. I told you what to say.
I saw Mr. Willoughby in court when he was district attorney. I know how he works on people when he cross-examines them.
And you're afraid of him?
No, I'm not afraid of him, but I'm not going to take any chances I can help. Besides, he asked about the will.
Sarah Bryant's will?
Yeah.
Well, what did you tell him?
I said exactly what you told me to say. So did Mr. Daniels. We both said we don't know where the will is.
But still, he's going out to the farm to see you.
Yeah, this afternoon, and I thought maybe he found out something we don't know about. I wanted to be sure.
Well, Willoughby was in my office for 3 hours this morning. He hasn't found out a thing.
Are you sure?
Well, why do you think I named him special prosecutor for this case? So I'll know every move he makes. Now, where are those certified checks?
Checks?
You and three certified checks belonging to Mrs. Bryant, totaling $5,175. The money John Todd paid her for her property. Well, I want those checks.
I don't see why we have to throw away all that money.
Oh, don't you, Mrs. Daniels? Well, I do. Where are they?
I've got them.
With you?
Yes, but that's a lot of money. It's ours.
Give me those checks. Come on, hand them over.
Morton and I did the work. You didn't. We're entitled to the money. It's ours.
Which is worth the most, those checks or your life? Do you want to go to the electric chair? Don't you know Willoughby's a bloodhound? Don't you know Bill Davidson and his daughter and son-in-law have got Willoughby positively convinced that you or your husband or I have those checks right now? Don't you know if those checks are found in your possession or mine, that will be the motive for murder? Haven't you any sense at all?
Well, I just thought, well, there's three checks. Maybe if we kept two of them, the biggest one, that's $3,500.
We won't keep any of Mrs. Bryant's checks. Give them to me.
So we don't get a dollar out of it.
You get your lives. You did an idiotic thing or we wouldn't be in this jam. I'll be thankful I'll be able to get you out of it. But remember, you never saw those checks. You don't know anything about any checks belonging to Mrs. Bryant.
All right.
And go on back to the county farm and stay there. Don't come near this house again. If I want to talk to you, I'll let you know when and where. Now, watch your step when Willoughby questions you. And try to put a little courage into that weak-kneed husband of yours. And don't forget for a minute, Bill Davidson is out to get us, and he's smart. If you want to stay out of the electric chair, follow my orders and leave the rest to me.
I still want to know what you're going to do with those checks. If you're going to throw away over $5,000,
We'll take a loss on this deal, but we'll make a profit later. That's all you need to know.
But for all we know, you'll keep the money. We won't get a nickel, and we did the work.
Listen, I'll say it once more for the last time. When I get through, Bill Davidson and his daughter and Carrie Donovan will be all through making trouble for me, you, your husband, or anybody else. They'll be in too much trouble themselves to be making more for us. They'll never get out of the trap I'm setting for them. Never. You'll see what I mean in a day or two. We're going to fool Mr. Willoughby and everybody. And I'll have my revenge on Bill Davidson.
Why, it's you, Mr. Willoughby.
Hello, Bill.
Well, I didn't expect to see you way down here in Hartville again tonight. Why, you look all in.
I am rather tired, Bill. It's been a long, confusing day for me.
Here, Mr. Willoughby. Sit down. Let me call Nancy. She's back in the kitchen. I'll have her bring in some hot coffee. Maybe you'd like something to eat.
Oh, no, Bill, thanks. Don't bother Nancy.
Oh, Nancy will want to hear whatever you've got to tell me. Oh, Nancy.
Yes, Daddy. What is it?
Mr. Willoughby's here. You better come in. Oh, and bring some coffee, will you?
Oh, yes, Daddy. I'll be in a minute.
You haven't been out at the county farm all this time, have you, Mr. Willoughby? From noon till now?
Yes, Bill, till about half an hour ago.
Well, something must have happened.
No, Bill, nothing happened. That's just the trouble. I've done the hardest job of cross-examination today I ever did. Found out absolutely nothing. I've got absolutely nowhere.
But surely people like Mort and Mrs. Daniels couldn't possibly stand up against you.
Well, they've been coached. That was obvious. A lawyer knows when a witness is answering questions by heart. I couldn't break them down.
Why, oh, here's Nancy. Oh,
good evening, Mr. Willoughby.
Good evening.
We didn't think we'd hear from you till tomorrow.
Mr. Willoughby has been at the county farm all this time.
Talking to Mort and Mrs. Daniels?
Yes, Nancy. Mostly talking to hear myself talk for all the results I got.
Here, Mr. Willoughby, drink this coffee.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, that helps some?
Yes, Bill, thanks. Well, as you know, I called the Daniels couple, told them I'd be out to see them, asked them about Mrs. Bryant's will, and they wouldn't tell me anything on the phone.
There was a will, though, wasn't there?
They say there was. They told me a perfectly straight story. Mrs. Bryant wrote a will in longhand. She refused to let them help or to let them see what she wrote.
And I suppose they claim they don't know where the will is.
They said they'll swear on the witness stand that Mrs. Bryant sent for them some time back and told them she had written her will, disposing of $5,175 in cash, represented by a certified check she got from John Todd.
They actually admit she had the checks?
No, Nancy. They only say she said she had them.
But even if they admit they knew about those checks that anybody could cash, that's the motive for murder, isn't it, Mr. Willoughby?
Yes, Nancy. But their story is that they never saw the checks. Mrs. Bryant told them she'd made a will and gave them the impression she was leaving the money in trust for Grace, her little granddaughter. She asked them to sign their names at the bottom of a single page of letter paper, her will, but refused to let them read a word of what she'd written.
That's their story.
Yes, Bill, that's their story. That they never saw the checks John Todd gave Mrs. Bryant. But they don't know where the will is or what it said. And the whole case rests on who has those checks, Mrs. Bryant's will, if it hasn't been destroyed.
But Mr. Willoughby, they must have those checks.
I believe they have, Nancy. Or at least know where the checks are. I believe, too, that Ira Brewster is as cowardly a crook as I've met in all my life. But I can't prove it. He seems to be wholeheartedly sincere in his determination to punish Mrs. Bryant's murderer.
So Brewster's got things all organized to keep us from finding out the truth.
Daddy, the telephone.
Yes, I'll get it, Nancy. Bill Davidson's barbershop. The what? Oh, yes. Just a minute. Mr. Willoughby, it's Ira Brewster calling you.
Ira Brewster? Calling here?
Maybe now we'll find out what he's been up to.
I hope so, Bill. Hello, Mr. Brewster. Yes, this is Willoughby speaking. What? Why, of course I'll come up to Hiawatha right away if you think it's necessary. I'll meet you at your office. Yes, yes, goodbye.
What now, Mr. Willoughby?
Mr. Brewster says Mrs. Bryant's missing will has just been found and is in his possession.
Who had it?
He refused to give me any details over the phone. But if the will has been found, we've come to the showdown, Bill. Who had it? And what it says, that's going to answer a lot of questions. If Mr. and Mrs. Daniels had it, we've got our motive for murder. And I'll ask for their arrest.
But they took their orders from Ira Brewster. We know they did. Would he dare arrest his own people?
Or has he got another scheme? Is he ready at last to spring something on us?
Just Plain Bill, the barber of Hartville, taking us back. Our guest is Evie Juster. We'll get back to our guest in just a moment.
This time of year is full of financial hurdles, including bills, federal income tax, and keeping up with spiraling winter fuel costs. A well-deserved spring vacation would be great, but you just can't work it into your budget. Luckily, there's help right around the corner. The folks at Cromwell Savings Bank or Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank will be delighted to chat with you. Their loan officers can help you arrange for a personal loan just when you need one the most. You'll find a friendly loan officer at any one of their six offices. Cromwell Savings has two, one at the corner of Main and West Streets in Cromwell, or at the new Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you, two in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. Stop in soon. Members FDIC.
Well, we promised to get back to the subject, Evie, and that is the contrast between radio, motion pictures, and the stage. And, of course, TV would be the same as motion pictures for the most part. But how do you contrast these three, then, as an actress? How do you feel the techniques vary between the three mediums?
Oh, I'm glad you reminded me. Now, they're each in its own, you know, the theater, films, television, and you mentioned radio, and you mentioned television. Well, each medium, you know, stands on its own merit. It stands quite strongly alone. However, the spillover or the borrowing from the different areas is what interests me very much. I mean, in the radio, for example, where we spent most of our conversation today here, your imagination is what propels you in a performance. You see the situation, you see the person, you see all the things that you're talking about, and you hope that in your being able, you know, you're seeing it, you as the performer, that you're transmitting this to the listener. And I really feel that if you are truthful in what you, you know, what you're doing, and I don't mean to sound stuffy by using that word truthful, but I mean, if it's real with you, and that they are really seeing it too. Now, of course, you've got script, and you've got dialogue, and you've got hopefully good dialogue, and a situation that is interesting. But you hone that imagination in radio, because you cannot do it without a good imagination. And the very doing of it does sharpen it, and it does make you more, a keener, more aware, you know?
Mm-hmm.
All right, now then you say, then you have the king and the queen of the mall, the theater, right? I mean, there you've got the full dimension.
That's right.
And this encompasses all of it. But I feel that if you're good in one area, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be good in another. Because in theater, it's your body, it's movement, it's timing, as it is in all acting. But it's the full dimension, you know, it's the three-dimensional. But you can use very, very well the other mediums that bring full life to it. Films is another. I mean, that's done in an entirely different way, where it's broken up, where even in a commercial, and I do commercials, and, you know, for a 60-second spot, you'll spend 8 hours. Each one gives to the other. And how marvelous to work in all of them.
Yes, that must be a very fortunate experience for any actress. Evie, I'd like to ask you, if you had your choice, if you'd like to hear a show that you appeared on.
Do you have any Theater Fives?
Yes, we do, as
I
a matter of
lots
fact.
Of those.
Well, let's hear Evie Juster in one of the Theater Fives, which were done at ABC about, what, a decade ago? Somewhere in that range.
About.
Can you see who it is, Garth?
Mrs. Brocaine.
Don't let her in.
You're worried.
Aren't you?
This is my home, Elspeth. I'll shelter anyone I choose, whether they like it or not. Yes?
You still got him here?
I have, and he'll stay as long as I care to keep him.
It's for your own good, I'm telling you, Garth Anson. We know about that boy now. Folks don't want unnatural things here.
What's unnatural about him? The fact that he knows how to laugh?
Well, you know what's unnatural. Seeing stars in daytime.
Or daring to say that you do.
What's that?
You hate him because he's different, don't you? Because what he is makes you uncomfortable. You hate his challenge, don't you?
My advice to you is to get him out of this house so we can get him out of this town. People are getting tired, you being this high-handed.
Good night, Mrs. Prokeen.
They're goading each other on. This can be very dangerous, Elspeth. We've got to do something right now.
But what? We can't put him out. We can't even let him go, not with people feeling this way.
Tonight, later, when it's dark, we've got to take him away.
Where?
Into the next town, wherever they haven't heard of him. We've got to have him keep this star thing secret.
Are we leaving our home, Garth?
Has it ever been that to you?
It has to you.
It isn't now.
It's too much to do for him.
No, I don't think so.
Yes, I was very gratified to announce last Sabbath that the threat has been removed. There is no further cause to fear. The child has been cast from among us. We will return to our accustomed virtues of order, reason, industry, sobriety. Let us give thanks.
Is it really true, Reverend? You say they left with the boy?
In the middle of the night, like thieves, they took him off.
But wasn't that what the council wanted?
Yes, Mrs. Stoner. The Ansons have sacrificed themselves to free us of an evil thing.
Is that what they did, Reverend?
We shall all sleep securely tonight, owing a debt to Garth Anson and firm in our knowledge of righteousness.
It's awful dark tonight. Father?
Yes, boy?
Why didn't you punish me for what I did to that boy?
The boy is gone. We will speak of it no more.
Look at the sky. There's not a star anywhere.
Oh, the wind. The wind stings my eyes. Funny the way it came up so sudden a week ago. Have you noticed the sky?
Notice how?
It isn't a cloudy sky. The moon's bright enough.
But where are the stars? There's not a single star.
Silas?
Yes, sir.
Oh, stay close, boy. Stay here by me.
It's dark. Where are you?
Here. Take my hand.
Does it just keep blowing? The whole week now.
Well, never mind. It'll pass.
The other boys are scared. They say if the sky is clear, there ought to be stars. They say maybe that boy
enough,
could...
Enough, Silas.
Hold my hand, Father. I'm used to the dark now. I'll take you where the others are gathered.
Follow us, Mrs. Brookeen. Take my other hand.
Yes, here, here. Oh, what are we going to do, Reverend? Why does the wind keep blowing? It hurts my eyes. I stood at the gate all day and asked the people from the other towns if their skies at home were dark. No, they said. The weather's been fine. The sky has been filled with stars. Why do you ask? How could I tell them why I asked? Could I say we have no stars? Could I say there's nothing but this lonely wind?
Oh, you're our pastor, Samuel. Tell us where the stars have gone.
Where are they, Reverend? Where are the stars?
I am not God, Mrs. Sona. How can I say where they are? You had no right to ask.
Oh, it isn't the dark I mind so much. It's that stinging in my eye. I'm old. We're all old tonight.
Father?
Yes, what is it, Silas?
Look. Look at the moon.
Yes. No, don't be frightened, boy.
But it's growing smaller.
It's fading. The moon is fading away.
It's getting smaller and smaller. Father? Father?
The moon!
It's fading! It's going away!
My friends! Let us pray. We are gathered here, Almighty, to beseech the return of the stars. We are lost without the stars. The moon grows small and pale, like a dull coin in the black sky. Return us to the light.
What's everybody waiting for, Father? Why do they just stand here in the square?
They're hoping.
Oh, we've got to find them, Reverend. We've got to find Garth and his wife and that boy.
We must get them back. We must bring the boy back to us.
If we can.
He'll come back if we find him.
Hold a meeting. Send off the town. Send everyone to find him.
Look, if all of us search, yes. If we all look everywhere. Oh, speak to them, Reverend. Speak to them now. Send them out to find him.
Yes. My people, yes. I ask you to listen. The boy must be brought back among us. We must search for him in every town around us.
Oh, how much further. How far must we walk?
It's just across this ridge.
Oh, it's dark. Oh, the wind stings my eyes. I'll just stay here.
No, help her up, Silas. We can't leave her here.
Oh, I'm old. It's too far to climb.
Come. You've been on the ridge road before. We'll soon be at the top. Come now. Come.
Wait. Hold up the lantern, Silas.
What's the matter?
The road here. It's overgrown as though we wandered off.
We haven't. It's solid underfoot.
What are these vines? What are these trees and weeds? The road is blocked. It ends here in the tree.
Oh, Janet. I was on it a week ago.
Father, look. Look down below.
Where?
It's gone! It's gone! Oh, the town!
There's no light below! The town is gone!
The moon! Look at the moon!
It's getting so small!
It's dripping faster! Faster!
It's like a drop of dew out there!
It's going!
It's going! It's going!
Where is it? Where is it?
Where is the moon? Where are the stars?
There's Viga in the Leary group. And there's Beta Centauri and Deneb. Out there is Regulus and Procyon.
Theater 5 has presented The Noon Stars, written by Richard McCracken and directed by Ted Bell. In the cast, Paul McGrath, Alice Yerman, Cecil Roy, Tom McDermott, Lorraine McMartin, Evelyn Juster, and Bryna Rayburn. Original music by Alexander Vlastatsenko. Orchestra under the direction of Glenn Osser. This is Fred Foy speaking.
An excerpt from Theater 5 with our guest E.V. Juster. We'll get back in just a moment.
Spring is officially here. If 1977 is the year that you plan some improvements to your home or property, stop in soon and chat with the folks at Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank or their Cromwell Savings Bank division. Perhaps that much-needed family room is tops on your priority list. Maybe it's a dormer and the enlarging of those upstairs bedrooms you've been contemplating, or a new patio or driveway. Whatever the reason, get complete information on a home improvement loan now. You'll find Cromwell Savings Bank located at the corner of Main and West Streets and the Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart in Cromwell, with convenient Saturday hours, 9 to noon. And Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has 4 offices to serve you, 2 in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. With the exception of the Middletown office on Main Street, they're also open Saturdays from 9 to noon. Visit them soon. Let them show you how a home improvement loan can help you. Members FDIC and Equal Housing Lenders. Once again, Dick Bertel.
Evie Jester, it's been a pleasure having you on the Golden Age of Radio. You haven't done any children's voices for us.
Oh, you know, really. It's just crazy. I think that one of the reasons that I do the mystery show a lot is because of the doubling. In other words, I do different characters, and which I love to do. And so that therefore people like myself, and there are many of us, who do several voices, many. You know, we have a stretch of vocal register that we can employ, and dialects to go along with it, or character types that we can, you know, grab onto quickly. Because of the imagination thing that we honed so well, sharpened, like you did do a razor on a strap, okay, all those years, which now is like coming home to roost. You know, now it stands you in really good stead. So as for the children, yes, I do children, but I'm not really too comfortable. I do a little boy that is kind of like a character little boy, but he was real. This little boy that I use, and I did it on, can I name products?
Oh, sure.
Oh, okay. I did it on, particularly on a Lysol. I had a series on that, of this little kid. And I copied my nephew. And he had one of those scratchy little voices, and that's just about how he sounded. So I used that little boy for the Lysol commercial.
That's excellent. Evie Jester, thank you so much for being our guest here on the Golden Age of Radio.
Thank you for asking me. It's been just lovely.
And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and their Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Hometown friends serving your best banking interest in every way. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bob Sharago and Dick Bertel.
Rinse so white and rinse so bright.
Strike program starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Bill Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and...